Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Just because somebody in Washington says it doesn't mean it's true, you know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, today the 16th day of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You might have seen this yesterday. The new Congressional Budget Office 10-year budget and economic outlook, one not small part of which was that the CBO figures the Treasury Department is going to run out of ways to move money around and thus keep us technically in compliance with the debt limit somewhere in the July to September timeframe. That is not necessarily new information. Treasury's been saying essentially the same thing. But it did remind me of something I have been wanting to talk about for a while now.
So what I really think we would do is treat this like we would treat our own household. If you had a child, you gave them a credit card, and they kept hitting the limit, you wouldn't just keep increasing it.
Kevin McCarthy, the Speaker of the House, last month saying the federal budget and debt limit are the same thing as a household credit card.
No.
No?
It's not the same thing.
We are comparing kind of apple and orange here.
That's Deborah Lucas at MIT, Golnaz Moti at Western Kentucky University, actual trained professional economists. So that settles it, right? I thought so. Wall Street on this Thursday, maybe not so great. Details, numbers, when we get there. Oh, man. Hey, Sarah, wait. Sarah, can we stop for just a second here?
What do you mean?
Can we just stop? There's something else I need to say.
No, I'm literally directing right now. We can't just stop.
Tell you what, let's finish the bridge. I'll do my thing and then you can figure out the time later, okay?
Okay, yeah.
Okay, good. Thanks. Okay, so look, because we believe firmly on this program that context matters, I am, as I said, going to explain this some more. The reason this not right talking point keeps coming up is because it's easy to understand. Both households and governments have money coming in and money going out, right? So what do you mean they're not the same thing? Well, for starters, the federal government has more to do, way more to do than any household ever will. Here's Golnaz Moti again.
The government has a lot of obligations that cannot wait. For example, a handbag can wait, but a payment of an employee of the federal government cannot wait.
There are 4 million federal employee paychecks. That's twice a month. There are the not inconsiderable expenses of national security, building and maintaining infrastructure, paying our obligations under economic treaties and foreign alliances. Oh, and Social Security and Medicare, too, to name just a couple of easy ones. Also,
even the greatest person with the greatest credit score is just one step away from destroying that credit score by losing their job or missing one payment.
And that is just not the case for the feds, unless we dance around default, about which more in a minute. But back to the topic at hand.
Households and governments and the tools that are available to them are not the same.
The tools most households have, we all know. Paychecks, savings, borrowing maybe for big purchases like cars and mortgages, some return on investments. The government's tools, though, what Fed Chair Jay Powell calls the great fiscal power of the United States, is something else entirely, and I'll give you two examples. Number one, taxes, people, right?
As we all know, it's not so easy to walk away from your taxes. So the IRS has strong enforcement mechanisms.
That's Deborah Lucas again at MIT. The federal government can literally decide how much income it wants.
Governments have the potential to control the money coming in more.
It's right there in the Constitution, Amendment 16. Total federal revenue last fiscal year, $4.9 trillion. That's individual income taxes, corporate taxes, Social Security and Medicare taxes, customs duties, everything. Example number two is bonds. When Washington needs to spend more money than it's taking in, which for most of the past century or two has been all the time, the government borrows big in the bond market. And there are always buyers, individuals, big banks, foreign governments, the Federal Reserve, to name just a couple, because
government debt is perceived as being quite safe, and so it carries a lower interest rate.
For now, because the closer House Republicans take us to breaching the debt limit, the higher those interest rates on the bonds the federal government issues are going to be, thus, the more we are going to owe. But if you take anything from what I just said, it's that there should be some serious conversations about how the government spends our money. But the idea that we should think about federal spending and the debt limit like it's a household budget and credit card, that just doesn't hold up. Our friends at the Bureau of Labor Statistics shared with us the Producer Price Index this morning. Prices at the wholesale level, what suppliers charge retailers, up 0.7% in January, more than anybody'd been guessing, and the biggest monthly jump since June. The year-on-year PPI is 6%, again, bigger than expectations. Now, what can that tell us? Marketplace's Lily Jamali spent her day digging into that.
Today's PPI figures come just 2 days after the CPI, reflecting consumer prices, came out. Different day, different data, all pointing to a reversal in inflation or disinflation. But there's a catch, says Tim Leary, senior portfolio manager at RBC Blue Bay.
We don't appear to be disinflating as quickly as some hoped.
Inflation is sticking around. Energy prices up 5% were the biggest driver in the rise of prices for goods. On the other hand, food prices for suppliers dropped 1% month over month, which Leary sees as a bright spot.
Over the last 12 months, food was one of the largest sources of inflation for Americans.
This brings us to why PPI matters, and not just to policymakers. Economist Leah Brooks of George Washington University explains.
You should care as a consumer about PPI because it's a hint about what's going to happen to your consumer prices in the future.
Brooks says PPI is an important window into what's happening in supply chains.
Like, I can now reliably get toilet paper at my Costco.
But she can't reliably get her preferred brand of tomato paste. Swings in producer prices are often traceable to supply chain disruptions. If PPI stays elevated, that hits revenues and profit margins, says Joe Brusuelis, chief economist at RSM.
And that's how you get to a point where unemployment increases. And at the end of the day, jobs, jobs, jobs are what we care about.
He says big picture, the latest PPI report shows policymakers are a long way off from declaring victory on inflation. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
As the possibility of a recession in this economy continues to be in the wind, witness all the companies talking about economic uncertainty as they announce layoffs, DocuSign today being the latest, cutting about 10% of its workforce. There is the flip side of that coin that is not getting anywhere near the same coverage. There is plenty of hiring news happening, too. Fidelity, for instance, the big asset manager, says it's going to hire 4,000 people the first half of this year. So the assignment for Marketplace's Kristen Schwab today? Square all those different takes we're hearing about the American labor market.
There's so much hiring happening in the hospitality industry right now that Marty Terabar at recruitment agency Gecko Hospitality says new restaurants are sitting empty, waiting to open, and hotels are limiting how many rooms they book.
When I asked their management what's going on, he said, listen, we don't have the staff to do it, so we'd rather just do it right in a smaller footprint.
He says most employers have increased salaries and benefits, but there just aren't enough qualified candidates to go around. A lot of hospitality workers who were laid off during the pandemic found new jobs in retail and warehouses.
They're working less hours, making the same pay in their home with their families, not working till 2 o'clock in the morning in the kitchen. And they are scratching their head and say, well, why would I go back?
Leisure and hospitality was the leading sector for jobs growth last month, and employment in those industries is still below what it was pre-pandemic. Meanwhile, the overall unemployment rate is the lowest it's been in more than 50 years. Elise Gould is an economist at the Economic Policy Institute.
So the picture right now is actually still pretty rosy, so you're not seeing that kind of slowdown in a lot of the top-line jobs numbers.
So why is there so much economic anxiety in the air? The truth is, hiring and firing happens all the time. But as the Fed raises interest rates, we're all a little sensitive to layoff announcements coming from big companies.
I think that weighs on people, and people may think that their job is less secure than it actually is.
Most of the layoffs making headlines are in tech, which is its own special case study. Nick Bunker, an economist at the job site Indeed, which is a marketplace sponsor, says the industry overhired during the pandemic.
One way to interpret what's going on right now is less them sort of, you know, having to like slash everything to the bone. It's more that they are just retreating from the really optimistic outlook they had.
He says postings for tech jobs have declined 40%, but they're still higher than they were pre-pandemic. It could be a sign that many of those laid off workers are finding new jobs relatively fast. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Let's stay with jobs and hiring here for a second. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the dance industry is expected to grow 27% by the year 2031. The average for all occupations, by the way, about 5%. But even with that expected growth, though, the median wage for dancers in this economy is a little less than $19 an hour, on which making ends meet can be tricky. We first met Dallas-based dancer and choreographer Alexandra Light last year. We were talking about the Great Resignation. We got an update from her coming up straight ahead.
A lot of people don't realize that dancers, that we are a full-time job, first of all. A lot of people are like, oh, but what do you really do? And I'm like, no, being a ballet dancer is my full-time job. I mean, we're in rehearsal, you know, from 9 to 6 every day. I'm still performing as a professional dancer, so I feel like we've just sort of got back into the swing of things post-COVID as a company. Being a dancer is difficult financially because, we go on these periodic layoffs, so, you know, you have to really plan ahead for when you're going to be paid, when you're not going to be paid, and B, that the amount that we get paid is relatively low compared to, I mean, other jobs certainly, but also just other arts organizations. Most ballet companies don't employ their dancers for 52 weeks a year. It's often closer to 42. But I know that we went down to close to 30 as a, you know, as a stage performer. And depending on the company you're in, you're usually eligible for unemployment benefits. So depending on if you have another job, what your status is in other ways, you can go on unemployment benefits. Even the highest paid dancer is making $40,000 or less in my area. So, you know, if you have two dancers in a family trying to support kids, it's like nearly impossible. I think the industry can improve in ways to see dancers more financially supported if, you know, the paradigms around artists and pay improve. There's, you know, the idea of a starving artist, and just because you love doing something means that you shouldn't get paid to do it. And I've had people say things to me like, you know, I'm an eye doctor and I went to school and, you know, I get paid well for what I do, but I love what I do. And it doesn't make sense to me that you would also train and, you know, spend money becoming this thing that you can only do if you really put those years into training. But then you're, you know, the pay disparity is so massive. And like, I'm not saying that dancers need to get paid necessarily like eye doctors, but I do think that the arts are important and people are kind of coming around to that.
Alexandra Light, dancing and choreographing in Dallas, Texas. Coming up.
I was losing money every single day.
That is not good. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 431 points today, 1.25%, finished at 33,696. The NASDAQ down 214, 1.8%, 11,855. The S&P 500 down 57, about 1.4%, 4,090. We heard from Lily Jamali about what the producer price index can tell us. So, some wholesale and B2B stocks. How about that? Fastenal lost 0.1%. Cisco Systems up about 5.25%. Costco dropped 1.4%. Today, we heard from Kristen Schwab that despite all the layoffs we've been hearing about, there is some hiring going on. So, some HR stocks. How about that? Manpower Group fell 1%. Insperity added almost 2.5%. Corn Ferry International downsized about 0.4%. Today, bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note thus rose 3.85%. Keep an eye on the 10-year, gang. You're listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You can add the 2023 Farm Bill to the list of things an already distracted Congress is trying to get done this year. It is a massive government spending package, the Farm Bill is. Gets refreshed every 5 years or so. And in that way that Washington has, despite its name, most of the Farm Bill isn't actually about farming, but rather about food and nutrition programs. And it comes just as pandemic-era funding for a lot of those programs is running out and grocery costs are remaining stubbornly high. Marketplace's Savannah Marr is on that one.
The Farm Bill has propped up American agriculture since the Great Depression, but it wasn't until the 1970s that lawmakers tied crop subsidies to food assistance, says Vincent Smith with the American Enterprise Institute.
To ensure that farm districts and urban districts would coalesce to support funding for farm programs and for nutrition programs.
But every 5 years, it takes a political showdown to reach that consensus, particularly when it comes to spending on SNAP benefits, which got a boost during the pandemic. Elaine Waxman at the Urban Institute says that will be a debate flashpoint.
About whether the overall change, which increased underlying benefits, was appropriate and whether it was too much.
During a congressional hearing today, Republican lawmakers took aim at the overall size of the SNAP budget. Waxman says shrinking it in this year's farm bill would be a jolt for the program's 41 million recipients.
Because of the current inflation environment.
Another likely point of contention will be employment requirements for SNAP, which Dottie Rosenbaum with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says are too strict.
Those provisions that are already in law do not help people find employment. What they do is take food assistance away.
With Republicans controlling the House, we'll likely see a push to increase enforcement of work requirements.
It'll be a fight. That will be a fight.
That's Vincent Smith again with the American Enterprise Institute. He says the farm bill may be a symbol of political harmony, but the process of hammering out a new one won't be pretty. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Advertising. It's complicated here in this digital economy. Your phone and your laptop know where you have virtually been, which can obviously be a huge boon to companies that want to get in front of you. And that's why it was such a big deal a couple of years ago when Apple announced it would let users opt out of being tracked. In other words, iPhone and iPad devotees could withhold the details of their online lives from marketers, be able to show up on Facebook, for instance, without it knowing that you'd just been browsing luggage or towels or whatever. And in theory, that made life harder for all would-be advertisers. But as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, Apple's Do Not Track option is just one of a number of trends in digital advertising that are having an outsized impact on smaller businesses.
Back in 2018, Taylor Rootsala started a business called Never Stay Stagnant. It sells journals, notebooks people can use to keep track of their productivity. And the idea was to market the journals to people on social media.
As a new business, I would say 98% of my traffic was from Facebook and Instagram ads.
During the pandemic, the business took off. In part, she says, because a lot of people got more interested in self-improvement. But also because Facebook's ad platform helped her target exactly the customers she had in mind.
Facebook was able to be like, okay, this girl, she's 35, she just went through a divorce, she's struggling, she just changed her Facebook status. She absolutely needs something that's going to help her improve her life.
That changed when Apple started allowing users to opt out of tracking. That made it a lot harder for Rootsala to precisely target that just-divorced 35-year-old. So she had to put her ads in front of way more people in hopes of catching a few who'd be interested.
It made it a lot more expensive to serve my ads to my correct demographic.
So expensive, Rootsala pulled back on ad spending.
Because I just wasn't profitable at all. I was losing money every single day. And I was like, ads are just not working anymore. So I pulled back completely at the end of the year.
There's another factor at play that's hitting online advertising by small business. And that's big businesses. Rick Bruner, head of insights and analytics at Standard Media Index, a company that tracks what big companies spend on ads, says over the course of the pandemic, their spending on ads has gone up.
It did contract in 2020, but then it overcompensated in 2021, and it grew a little bit more in 2022.
That growth pushed the cost of advertising higher, says Andrew Lipsman, principal analyst at Insider Intelligence.
Ad markets and digital are driven, they're marketplaces and they're auction based. And so it is really driven by supply and demand.
Lipsman says digital ad prices went up anywhere between 20 and 50%.
And that completely changes the bottom line, especially for a lot of brands whose biggest costs often were digital advertising costs.
Another factor that may be increasing the price of advertising, at least according to the Department of Justice, is Google. Last month, the DOJ sued the company over its ad platform, which connects advertisers to publishers of sites where the ads are displayed. Florian Ederer is an economics professor at Yale.
One of the alleged misbehaviors is that Google
abuses its market power because it has a very, very dominant position in this market for online display ads.
A big issue, the DOJ says, is the roughly 20% commission Google takes when marketers buy ad space on its platform. Google says the DOJ lawsuit misrepresents its ad business. Ederer says big advertisers can avoid paying that commission by working directly with publishers, but
if you are a smaller player on either side of the market, either an advertiser or a publisher, then that's much, much harder. You would have to, you know, contact many, many different other parties on the other side of the market, and that's costly.
Online ad prices have been falling recently as big marketers have cut back on spending. But a lot of smaller businesses don't have a choice but to keep spending, no matter how much ads cost.
Right now, we're kind of keeping it constant.
That's Sophie Blake, who owns a jewelry company. Late last year, she shut down her brick-and-mortar store in Virginia and went online only. And that changed her whole approach to marketing.
When you're in physical retail, you can have that conversation with a customer. They will open up to you and tell you, hey, this is what's going on in my life. I've gotten an exciting promotion, you know, and let's celebrate. But on an e-com platform, it's really hard to do that.
Blake says she needs to advertise to bring in new customers. And when you advertise on social media,
you can actually directly message your customers. They directly message you back. They leave you likes or they save the content. So that's how you know they're engaging with you and you know that there's interest.
Blake says that's the kind of information she's looking for and that she used to get by talking to customers face to face. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, we don't typically do a whole lot of personnel news on this program, but this one is worth a mention. YouTube CEO Susan Wojcicki announced today she is going to step down after 9 years running that company. She literally said she's going to spend more time with her family, work on her health, and take on some personal passion projects. True, if somewhat stereotypical story, Google's founders Larry Page and Sergey Brin worked on early versions of their company in a Silicon Valley garage that they rented from Wojcicki. All right, off we go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. I know I said as the labor market's pandemic-induced spasms were calming down that we weren't going to be paying quite as much attention to the weekly report on first-time claims for unemployment benefits. It's usually a pretty volatile indicator. But I mentioned it today, it came out this morning, because it is another item on the list of indicators making the Fed scratch its head. 194,000 people filed first-time claims last week. That is A, down from a week earlier, B, really low, and C, it does nothing to make the Fed think it's going to be able to ease off on its rate hikes. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Bibawe is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.